Two. Please look. Can you see us? Can you see us in our little red car? Picture us from above, as if you were flying above us in, say, a helicopter or on the back of a bird, as our car hurtles low to the ground, straining on the slow upward trajectory, but still at 60, 65, around the relentless, sometimes ridiculous bends of Highway 1. Look at us, goddammit. The two of us slingshotted from the backside of the moon, greedily cartwheeling toward everything we are owed. Every day, we are collecting on what's coming to us. Each day, we're being paid back for what is owed, what we deserve, with interest, with some extra motherfucking consideration. We are owed, goddammit. And so we are expecting everything, everything. We get to take what we want, one of each, anything in the store, a 3-hour shopping spree, the color of our choice, any make, any color, as much as we want, when we want, whatever we want. Today we have nowhere to be, so we're on our way to Montara, a beach about 35 minutes south of San Francisco, and right now we are singing. She was alone, she never knew, something, something, something. When we touched, when we rhymed the same, all something, something. All night, all night, all every night. So hold tight, baby, hold tight. Any way you want it, that's the way you need it, any way you want it. Tov does not know the words, and I know few of the words, but you cannot fucking stop us from singing. I'm trying to get him to do the second all night part with me doing the first part, like me all night higher, him all night slightly lower. I point to him when his part comes, but he just looks at me blankly. I point to the radio, then to him, then to his mouth, but he's still confused, and it's hard doing any of this while trying not to careen off the road and into the Pacific, and I guess in a way the gestures look like I want him to eat the radio, but Jesus, he should be able to figure this out. He isn't cooperating. Or he could be dumb. Is he dumb? Fuck it. I go solo. I hit the Steve Perry notes. I do the Steve Perry vibrato. I can do these things because I am an extraordinary singer. Can I sing or what? I yell. What? He yells. The windows are open too. I said, can I sing or what? He shakes his head. What do you mean? I yell. I can sing, goddammit. He rolls up his window. What did you say? I didn't hear you, he says. I said, can I sing or what? No. He smiles hugely. You can't sing at all. I worry about exposing him to bands like Journey, the appreciation of which will surely bring him nothing but the opprobrium of his peers. Though he has often been resistant, children so seldom know what is good for them, I have taught him to appreciate all the groundbreaking music makers of our time. Big Country, Haircut 100, Loverboy. And he is lucky for it. His brain is my laboratory, my depository. Into it, I can stuff the books I choose, the television shows, the movies, my opinion about elected officials, historical events, neighbors, passers-by. He is my 24-hour classroom, my captive audience, forced to ingest everything I deem worthwhile. He is a lucky, lucky boy, and no one can stop me. He is mine, and you cannot stop me, cannot stop us. Try to stop us, you pussy! You can't stop us from singing, and you can't stop us from making fart sounds, from putting our hands out the window to test the aerodynamics of different hand formations, from wiping the contents of our noses under the front of our seats. You cannot stop me from having Tov, who is 8, steer on a straightaway while I take off my sweatshirt because suddenly it's gotten really fucking hot. You cannot stop us from throwing our beef jerky wrappers on the floor or leaving our unfolded laundry in the trunk for, fuck, 8 days now because we have been busy. You cannot stop Tov from leaving a half-full cardboard orange juice container under the seat where it will rot and ferment and make the smell in the car intolerable, with that smell's provenance remaining elusive for weeks, during which the windows must be kept open at all times, until finally it is found and Tov is buried to his neck in the backyard and covered in honey, or should have been, for his role in the debacle. We cannot be stopped from looking with pity upon all the world's sorry inhabitants, they unblessed by our charms, unchallenged by our trials, unscarred and thus weak, gelatinous. You cannot stop me from telling Tov to make comments about and faces at the people in the next lane. Me. Look at this loser. He. What a spaz. Me. Look at this one. He. Oh my God. $1 to wave at this guy. How much? $1. That's not enough. Okay, $5 to give this guy a thumbs up. Why a thumbs up?
Because he's got it going on. Okay, okay. Why didn't you do it? I just couldn't. It's unfair, the matchups. Us versus them, or you, are unfair. We are dangerous. We are daring and immortal. Fog whips up from under the cliffs and billows over the highway. Blue breaks from beyond the fog, and sun suddenly screams from the blue. To our right is the Pacific. And because we are hundreds of feet above the ocean, often with nothing in the way of a guardrail between us and it, there is sky not only above us, but below us, too. Toph does not like the cliff, is not looking down, but we are driving in the sky, with clouds whipping over the road, the sun flickering through, the sky and ocean below. Only up here does the earth look round. Only up here does the horizon dip at its ends. Only up here can you see the bend of the planet at the edges of your peripheries. Only here are you almost sure that you are careening on top of a big, shiny globe, blurrily spinning. You are never aware of these things in Chicago, it being so flat, so straight. And we have been chosen, you see, chosen, and have been given this, it being owed to us, earned by us, all of this. The sky is blue for us. The sun makes passing cars twinkle like toys for us. The ocean undulates and churns for us, murmurs and coos to us. We are owed. See, this is ours. See, we are in California, living in Berkeley, and the sky out here is bigger than anything we've ever seen. It goes on forever, is visible from every other hilltop. Hilltops! Every turn on the roads of Berkeley, of San Francisco. We have a house, a sublet for the summer, that overlooks the world up in the Berkeley Hills. It's owned by people, Scandinavians, Beth says, who must have some money because it's all the way up there and it's all windows and light and decks. And up there we see everything. Oakland to the left, El Cerrito and Richmond to the right, Marin forward, over the bay, Berkeley below, all red rooftops and trees of cauliflower and columbine, shaped like rockets and explosions, all those people below us with humbler views. We see the Bay Bridge, clunkety, the Richmond Bridge, straight, low, the Golden Gate, red toothpicks and string, the blue between, the blue above, the gleaming white land of the lost slash Superman's North Pole getaway magic crystals that are San Francisco. And at night, the whole fucking area is 1,000 airstrips. Alcatraz, blinking, the flood of halogen down the Bay Bridge, oozing to and fro, a string of Christmas lights being pulled slowly, steadily, and of course, the blimps. So many blimps this summer. And stars, not too many visible, with the cities and all, but still some. 100 maybe? Enough. How many do you need, after all? From our windows, from our deck, it's a lobotomizing view, which negates the need for movement or thought. It is all there. It can all be kept track of without a turn of the head. The mornings are film strip white, and we eat breakfast on the deck. And later, we eat lunch there. We eat dinner there. We read there, play cards, always with the whole thing, the postcard tableau, just there. All those little people, too much view to seem real, but then again, nothing really is all that real anymore. We must remember, of course. Or is it just the opposite? Is everything more real? Aha. Behind our house, not too far, is Tilden Park, an endless expanse of lakes and trees and hills, mohair hills touched by patches of shrubs, as in mohair hill, mohair hill, mohair hill, then an armpit of dark green, then the mohair hills that go on, like sleeping lions, as far as, especially when you're on your bike, starting from Inspiration Point, pedaling into the wind on your way in, and with the wind on the way back, the hills going on until Richmond, miles away, where the factories and power plants and big tanks full of deadly or life-giving things are, and the bike path goes the whole way there, all the while with the bay visible in the distance to the left, the hills on and on to the right, until Mount Diablo, the biggest of all of them, king of the Mohair Hills, 20 miles east, northeast, whatever. The paths are paralleled with and perpendiculared by wood and wire fences that hold cows, and sometimes sheep, and all this is minutes away, all there, from our house behind which there's even a hiking trail that reaches, just about reaches, the huge rock, Grotto Rock, that juts out 20 feet beyond our back deck, and on some days, when Toph and I are eating our breakfast out on the porch, with the sun crazy and happy for us, smiling and teary-eyed with pride, there will suddenly appear hikers, male and female, always coupled, in their khaki shorts and brown shoes and hats on backward, who will step up from below the rock and then be atop it and then be there, holding their backpack straps with their thumbs at eye level with us, as we eat our breakfast on our redwood deck, 20 feet away. "Hello," we say, Tove and I, with compact waves. Hello, they say, surprised to see us there, eating our breakfast at eye level. It is nice, this moment. Then it's awkward, because they are at the top, the end of their hike, and want only to sit down for a while and admire the view, but can't help but be conscious of these two people, impossibly handsome people, Tof and I, who are sitting not 20 feet behind them, eating Applejacks from the box. We drive past Half Moon Bay and Pacifica and Seaside, the condos on the left and the surfers on the right, the ocean exploding pink. We pass through cheering eucalyptus and waving pines. Cars reflect wildly as they come at us. They seem to come right for us. And I look through their windshields for the faces of those coming at us, for a sign, for their understanding, for their trust. And I find their trust, and they go by. Our car thrums loudly, and I turn up the radio because I can. I drum the steering wheel with open palms, then fists because I can. Tof looks at me. I nod gravely. In this world, in our new world, there will be rocking. We will pay tribute to music makers like Journey, particularly if this is Two for Tuesday, which means inevitably that one of the songs will be Just a Small Town Girl. There are times when I am concerned about Tof's expression when I am really singing, with vibrato and all, singing the guitar parts. His expression, one that to the untrained eye might look like abject terror or revulsion, but I know well enough that it is awe. I understand his awe. I deserve his awe. I am an extraordinary singer. We have found a school for Tof, a peculiar little private school called Black Pine Circle, which has given him what amounts to a full scholarship, even though we could pretty comfortably pay for the tuition. We have some money from the house, from the insurance policy our father took out shortly before his death. Things have been taken care of, but because we are owed, we take the free ride. It's largely Beth's doing, Beth being as much or more owed than Tof and I, and she being gloriously adept at wringing money from our situation. It worked for her law school tuition, which, considering her stated status as a single parent, was waived. Even if it wasn't free, Beth would still be, as she is, half delirious with joy about getting back onto campus in the fall, a few months hence, slipping back into that world and letting it overtake her, fleshing out the everything about last year. She is giddy, hyper. And we are both blowing the summer because we are owed. I'm doing nothing much. Tof and I are playing frisbee or going to the beach. I'm taking a class in furniture painting, and I am taking the class very seriously. I am spending a good deal of time painting furniture in the backyard, and while I am applying my 12 years of art education to the painting of furniture, I am wondering what I will do in a more general, futuristic sense. What exactly I will do. My furniture is good, I think. I am taking thrift store furniture, end tables mostly, sanding them down and then painting on them pictures of fat men's faces, blue goats, and lost socks. I have it in my head that I will sell these tables, will find a boutique somewhere in town, and will sell them for, say, $1,000 per, and when I am hard at work on one of my tables, deep inside one, you might say, solving the unique problems of a new piece, is this rendering of a severed foot too facile, too commercial? It seems that what I am doing is noble, meaningful, and will all too likely make me celebrated and wealthy. I come inside in the afternoon, remove my thick rubber gloves, and on the deck, as the sun sets, I permit my own bright glow to subside for the evening. Maybe I will have to get a job at some point, but for the time being, for the summer at least, I am allowing us time to enjoy this lack of anything, this lack of humidity, this time to look around. Tof is going to summer camp on the Berkeley campus, run by the university's athletes, and his skills at everything from lacrosse to football to baseball and frisbee make it obvious that soon enough he will be a three-sport, at least, professional athlete and will marry an actress. We assume more scholarships, more gifts spread before us by the embarrassed and sorry world. Beth and I take turns driving him to and fro, down the hill and up again, and otherwise we lose weeks like buttons, like pencils. The cars flash around the turns of Highway 1, jump out from cliffs, all glass and light. Each one could kill us. All could kill us. The possibilities leap into my head. We could be driven off the cliff and down and into the ocean. But fuck, we'd make it. Toph and I, given our cunning, our agility, our presence of mind, yes, yes, if we collided with a car at 60 miles per hour on Highway 1, we could jump out in time. Yes, Toph and I could do that. We're quick thinking. This is known. Yes, yes. See, after the collision, as our red Civic arced through the sky, we would quickly plan out. No, we would instantly know the plan, what to do, the plan, of course, being obvious, so obvious. As the car arced downward, we would each, simultaneously, open our doors, car still descending, then each make our way to the outside of the car still descending, each on one side of the car, and then we would stand on the car's frame for a second, car still descending, each holding onto the open car door or the car roof, and then, ever so briefly, as the car was now only 30 feet or so above the water, seconds until impact, we would look at each other knowingly. You know what to do. Roger that. We wouldn't actually say these words, wouldn't need to. And then we'd both, again, simultaneously, of course, push off the car so as to allow the appropriate amount of space between our impact and the car's once we all landed. And then, as the Civic crashed into the ocean's mulchy glass, we would too, though in impeccable diver's form, having changed our trajectory mid-flight, positioning our hands first, forward and cupped properly, our bodies perpendicular to the water, our toes pointed. Perfect! We'd plunge under, half-circle back to the surface, and then break through into the sun, whip our heads to shake the water from our hair, and then swim to each other as the car, with bubbles, quickly drowned. Me. Whew! That was close. He. I'll say. Me. You hungry? He. Hey, you read my mind. Toph was in Little League, too. On a team coached by two black men, these two black men being numbers one and two among the black men that Toph has ever known, his team, and the coaches too, as a matter of fact, wear red uniforms and practice on a field in a pine-surrounded park two blocks up the hill from our sublet, where the view is even more startling. I bring a book to the practices, guessing that watching 8 to 10-year-olds run drills will be boring, but it is anything but. It's enthralling. I watch every movement. Watch them gather around the coach for instructions, watch them shag balls, watch them go to the drinking fountain. No, I don't watch all of them. Of course not. I watch Toph, follow his new, oversized red felt hat moving through the drills, watch him waiting his turn, watch him field a ground ball, turn and throw it to the coach at second. Watch only him, even as he's waiting in line, to see if he's talking with the other kids, if he's getting along, strain to see if he's being accepted, though I occasionally catch one of the black kids doing something extraordinary. There are two stars, a boy and girl, both tall and fast and preternaturally gifted, miles ahead of all the rest, loose and lazy with their talent. During the drills, I wait for Toph's turn, and when it comes time for him to field a ground or a cover second for a 4-3-2, I almost die from the pressure. Should have had that one. Good. Oh, God, come on. I say nothing, but it's all I can do to avoid making noises. He catches well, can catch anything, really. We've been working on that since he was 4, but the hitting? Why can't the kid hit? A lighter bat? Choke up! Quick bat! Jesus Christ, that was served up like a fat fucking steak! Hit the ball! Hit that coconut, boy! I was never much of a baseball player, but did pretend to know enough to land a job as a t-ball coach and sports camp director during half of my high school and college summers. When Toph was old enough, he attended, came in with me every day, gloating shyly in the celebrity born of being the brother of the camp director, as dashing as he was. I watch, and the mothers watch. I do not know how to interact with the mothers. Am I them? They occasionally try to include me in a conversation, but it's clear they don't know what to make of me. I look over and smile when one of them makes a joke that is laughed at by all. They laugh, I chuckle. Not too much. I don't want to seem overeager, but enough to say, I hear you. I laugh with you. I share in the moment. But when the chuckling is over, I am still apart, something else, and no one is sure what I am. They don't want to invest their time in the brother sent to pick up Toph while his mother cooks dinner or is stuck at work or in traffic. To them, I'm a temp, a cousin maybe, the young boyfriend of a divorcee. They don't care. Fuck it. I don't want to be friends with these women anyway. Why would I care? I am not them. They are the old model, and we are the new. I watch Toph interact with the other kids, scanning, guessing, suspecting. Why are those kids laughing? What are they laughing at? Is it Toph's hat? It's too big, right? Who are those little pricks? I'll break those little fuckers. Oh, it was just that. After practice, we walk home, down the road, Marin Road, a pure 45-degree monster. It's almost impossible to walk it without looking ridiculous, but Toph has invented a walk that surmounts the problem. It's a kind of groovy walk with his legs bent extravagantly, his arms sort of swimming in front of him, a grabbing of air and sending it behind him in a way that makes him look, in the end, much more normal than the arm-flailing, soul-slapping awkwardness the road normally necessitates. It's an extremely happening walk. As we hit our street, Spruce, and the ground flattens out, I inquire, as gently as I possibly can, about his hitting, or lack thereof. So why do you suck so much at hitting? I don't know. Maybe you need a lighter bat? You think? Yeah, maybe we'll get a new bat. Can we? Yeah, we'll look for a new bat or something. Then I push him into a bush. We are still driving. We are going to the beach. While we drive, when there is not Watershed Rock and Roll on the radio, Watershed Rock and Roll conceived and executed by masters of modern music making, we play word games. There must be noise. There must be music and games. No silence. We are playing the game where you have to come up with the names of baseball players, using the first letter of the last name to start the next first name. Jackie Robinson, I say. Randy Johnson, he says. Johnny Bench, I say. Who? Johnny Bench, Reds catcher. Are you sure? What do you mean? I've never heard of him. Johnny Bench? Yeah. So? So maybe you're making him up. Toph collects baseball cards. He can name the going price for every card he owns. Thousands, if you count the collection he inherited from Bill. Still, though, he doesn't know anything about anything. I stay cool, though he deserves to have his head knocked against the window. You should hear the sound that makes. It's amazing. Even he says so. Johnny Bench? Johnny fucking Bench? Trust me, I say. Johnny Bench. We stop at a beach on the way. I stop at this beach because I have heard about the existence of beaches like these. And then, on the fat side of a wide bend, a few miles from Monterra, there is this certain beach, this beach with a sign that says Nude Beach. I am suddenly reeling with curiosity. I pull over, jump out of the car. Is this it? He asks. Maybe, I say. Lost. Dizzy. And almost run across the highway to the entrance before pausing for Toph and my thoughts to catch up. Is this okay? I think this is okay. This is not okay. I know what to do. I know what is right. Is this right? This is fine. This is fine. Nude Beach? Fine. Nude Beach. Nude Beach. We walk to the entrance. A bearded man sitting on a stool with a gray metal box on his lap wants $10 each to enter. Is he $10 too? I ask, indicating the 8-year-old boy next to me, wearing a cow sweatshirt and a cow baseball hat, worn backward.
Yes, the bearded man says.
I glance beyond the bearded man, down the cliff, trying to catch a glimpse of the beach below, trying to see if it's worth it. $20? For $10, there had better be some very impressive nude women down there, and not just life drawing class nude women. This is okay. This is educational. It's natural. We're in California. All is new. No rules. The future. I'm almost convinced. I step over to the bearded man, out of Toast's earshot, and try to get the lowdown. So, like, are kids allowed down there?
Of course.
But is it, like, weird?
Weird? What about it would be weird?
You know, for a little kid. Is it too much?
Too much of what? Of the human body?
He says it in a way that's meant to make me seem like the freak. He, Mr. Natural, and me some kind of clothes fascist? Never mind, I say. Stupid beach. Probably just a bunch of naked guys with beards, bony and pale. We run back across the highway, back into the red Civic, and keep driving. Past the surfers, through the eucalyptus forest before Half Moon Bay, birds swooping up and over, then back, circling around us. They too, for us. Then the cliffs before Seaside, then flat for a little while, then a few more bends, and can you see this motherfucking sky? I mean, have you fucking been to California? We left Chicago in a blur. We sold most of the stuff in the house, the stuff we didn't want to move with. Had this busy little woman come in and price everything to tell the appropriate people about it. She apparently has a mailing list of devout shoppers, enthusiasts of possessions of the recently dead.
about the estate sale for 924 Waveland, and then we got out of the way. When they were done, just about everything was gone, and we picked through the remains. Some of Toph's old He-Man dolls, some coffee mugs, random pieces of silverware. We packed up the things we had saved. Quite a lot, actually. 60 boxes, maybe. And the things that hadn't sold, put them all in a truck, and now all of it sits in our Spruce Street sublet's low-slung garage. Bill kept Mom's car, sold it. Beth sold Dad's car and bought a Jeep, and I made the rest of the payments on the Civic that Dad and I had bought together just before, so I could get home on the weekends. In Berkeley, we're living with Beth and her best friend, Katie, also an orphan, both gone by the time she was 12, and my girlfriend, Kirsten, who always wanted to live in California and so came out too. Between the five of us, there was only one parent still living, Kirsten's mother, and so at first we were smug about our independence. We orphans would surely recreate domestic life from scratch without precedent. It seemed like a great idea, all of us in the house together. Just like college, like a commune, sharing the babysitting, the cleaning, the cooking, big meals together, parties, joy, for at least 3 or 4 days, after which it became obvious, for all the obvious reasons, that it was not at all a good idea. We were all vibrating with the stress of the sundry adjustments, new schools and jobs, and we all quickly begin to snip and snap and complain about whose newspapers are whose, who should know not to buy granular dishwasher detergent. Doesn't everyone know such things? My God. Kirsten, with student loans to pay and little savings, is trying frantically to get a job but has no car, and she won't let me pay her portion of the rent. I can pay it. Don't worry about it. I'm not letting you pay it. The martyr rides again. Even though I can pay it, she won't allow things to be easy, even for the summer. So I drive her to the BART in the morning on the way to taking Toph to camp, and together, Kirsten and I twitch and jiggle with tension, looking for reasons to attack, explode, let it go, not knowing if we'll be living together in the fall, if we'll have jobs by the fall, if we'll even still be in love in the fall. The house amplifies our problems. Its alliances, Toph and I, Katie and Beth, Beth and Kirsten and Katie, and resulting skirmishes making the place claustrophobic, even with the view, and generally putting a damper on the fun Toph and I are trying desperately to create. For example, we soon discover that, because the floors of the house are wood, and the house sparsely furnished, there are at least two ideal runways for sock sliding. The best is the back deck to stairway run, which allows, with only a modest running start, one to glide easily 30 feet, all the way to the stairs leading to the lower floor, the first half of which can be jumped, provided one is prepared to drop and shoulder roll upon hitting the landing, which, if stuck, should be punctuated with a Mary Lou Retton arm raise and back arch. Yes, America. Our best trick, though, is to pretend, for the benefit of the neighbors and whoever's around, that I'm beating Toph with a belt. This is how. With the back deck door open, we stand in the living room and then, with the belt buckled into a circle, I yank it quickly on either end, snapping it taut and making a sound not unlike that produced if I were striking Toph's bare legs at full force. When it cracks, Toph squeals like a pig. Belt. Whack. Toph. Squeal. Me. How does that feel, kid? Toph. I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. Me. Yeah? You'll never walk again. Whack. Squeal. Etc. It's great fun. We are attacking California, Toph and I, devouring what we can before the fall comes and hems us in. And so while Beth and Katie do whatever they do, and Kirsten does job interviews, Toph and I drive down to Telegraph and look at the weirdos. We walk around the campus searching for the naked guy, or tie-dye people, or Hare Krishnas, Jews for Jesus, for the topless women who walk around, daring people to complain, who troll for TV cameras and cops, issuing unfair citations. We see no breasts and never find the naked guy, but one day we do see the naked older man, gray-bearded, chatting casually on a payphone, naked but for flip-flops. We eat at Fat Slice, maybe drive down to the Berkeley Marina, and at the park at the end of the jetty, green and hilly and right there in the middle of the bay, practically, we take out the bats and mitts, a football and a frisbee, always in the car, all of it, and we throw things and roll around. There are errands, groceries, and bad haircuts to get, and then the slow, quiet nights, no TV in the house, and then bed, where we read, talk on his little bed. It's weird. Already I can hardly remember them, he says one night, the words burning and unstoppable, and then has to sit through an hour of pictures and remember? Remember? See, you remember. Of course you do.
And then Kirsten and I sleep in a room overlooking everything, the same view as the living room and porch above, with Beth next door and Toph sleeping. He sleeps like a dream. 2-3 minutes and he's out, in a makeshift home for him we've made with a curtain and a futon out of the area between our bedrooms. We get to Montera, the beach, and park above it, next to a van, behind which a blonde man is taking off a rubber suit. We get our stuff and walk down from above the cliff to below on a set of rickety steps, the Pacific cheering heartily for us. Look at us, lying parallel, he with his shirt on, embarrassed to take it off. This is us talking. Are you bored? Yeah, he says. Why? Because you're just lying there. Well, I'm tired. Well, I'm bored. Why don't you go down and build a sandcastle? Where? Down there, by the water. Why? Because it's fun. How much do I get? What do you mean, how much do you get? Mom used to pay me. To build a sandcastle? Yeah? I pause to think. I am slow. Why? Because? Because why? I don't know. How much did she give you? $1? That's crazy. Why? Pay you to play in the sand? Forget it. You won't play in the sand unless I pay you? I don't know. I might. The ocean is too cold, and the drop-off too steep, and the undertow too strong to allow for swimming. We are sitting, watching the water and foam run madly through our moats and tunnels. He is not the best swimmer, and the waves hit the shore hard, and I get a flash. I'm watching another Toph drowning, 20 feet out. He got pulled out, into the maw. The wave came in and scooped him, and that fucking undertow. I run and jump and swim like a miracle to get him. I was on a swim team. I can swim and dive, fast and strong, but I'm too late. I go under again and again, but it's all gray, the sand churning, swirling, the water hazy, and then it's too late. He's been pulled hundreds of feet out by now. When I come up for air, I can see his little arm, tan and thin, one last wave and gone. We should not swim here, ever. Hey, we can swim in pools. Hey, what? What's the deal with your nipples? He asks. What do you mean? Well, they sort of stick out. I look him in the eye. Toph, I want to tell you something. I want to tell you about my nipples. I want to tell you about my nipples and generally about the nipples of the men in our family. Because someday, son, I do this thing and he does this thing where I call him son and he calls me dad when we are having funny father-son type chats, mocking them in a way while also being secretly, deeply queasy about using these terms. Someday my nipples will be your nipples. Someday you too will have nipples that protrude unnaturally far from your chest and which will harden at the slightest provocation, preventing you from wearing anything but the heaviest cotton t-shirts. No way. Yes, Toph, I say, looking out to the ocean thoughtfully, seeing the future. You will inherit these nipples, and you will inherit a scrawny, rib-showing frame that will not at all fill out until your early 20s, and puberty will hit you impossibly late, and soon the beautiful blonde straight hair that you like so much, that you wear long and which helps you look like the young River Phoenix, this hair will thicken, harden, darken, and curl so tightly and wildly that when you wake up, you will appear to have permed your hair 3 times and then ridden for 6 hours in a convertible. You will slowly grow ugly, with skin riddled with acne so persistent that on top of the general zittiness that will roughen your cheeks and chin, you will get red skin globules. Your dermatologist will call them cysts that will every other week set up shop in the crevice above your nostril and will be so large and so red that strangers at 20 yards will gasp. Small children will point and cry. No. Yes. No way. I'll be different, I bet. Pray for it. It's windy, but when you are lying down, listening to the sand, it's warm, warm, warm. Toph is sitting up, burying my feet. There is so much to do. I try not to think yet about everything coming soon, all the things we need to do when school starts and all this becomes real. But one thing, that Toph must see a doctor, must get a physical, breaks through and now my head floods. Fuck. I have to get a resume together and we have to find a new place to live when the sublet ends and how will Toph get to school if I get an early job? Will Beth pull her weight? Will she be too busy? Will we kill each other? How often will Bill come up from L.A.? How much should I, can I, will I burden Kirsten? Will she even be around? Will she mellow when she finds a job and a car? Should I lighten my hair? Does that whitening toothpaste really work? Toph needs health insurance. I need health insurance. Maybe I'm already sick. It's already growing inside me. Something. Anything. A tapeworm? AIDS? I have to get started. Have to get started soon, because I will die before 30. It will be random, my death. Even more random than theirs. I will fall somehow. Will fall like she fell when I found her. I was 6, and it was midnight, and I found her when she fell down the stairs and opened up her head on the black slate floor. I had heard her moaning, and I walked down the hallway, the green carpet floor, and at the top of the stairs I saw a figure in a nightgown, crumpled at the bottom. I walked slowly down the stairs in my pajamas with feet, my hand on the railing, having no idea who this was, almost knowing, but not knowing at all, and when I was near enough I heard her, the voice, hers. I wanted to see the flower. I wanted to see the flower, she was saying, 3 or 4 times. I wanted to see the flower. Then there was the blood, black on the black slate floor, her hair matted with blood, now red, brown, glistening. I woke my father up, and then there was the ambulance. She came home wearing a bandage around her head, and for weeks I was not sure she was her. I wanted it to be her, believe it was her, but there was the possibility that she had died, and this now was someone else. I would have believed anything. It's too cold to lie bare-chested. I get up, and Toph gets up, and he runs, and I throw the frisbee ahead of him, leading him by a good 20 yards, but the frisbee, because I have thrown it perfectly, floats up, floats slowly, and he reaches it with time to spare, overtakes it, stops, turns, and catches it between his legs. Oh, we are good. He's only 8, but together we are spectacular. We play by the shore, and we run barefoot, padding and scratching into the cold, wet sand. We take 4 steps for each throw, and when we throw, the world stops and gasps. We throw so far, and with such accuracy, and with such ridiculous beauty. We are perfection, harmony, young and lithe, fast, like Indians. When I run, I can feel the contracting of my muscles, the strain of my cartilage, the rise and fall of pectorals, the coursing of blood, everything working, everything functioning perfectly, a body in its peak form, albeit on the thin side, just a bit shy of normal weight, with a few ribs visible, which, come to think of it, might look weird to Toph, might look kind of anemic, might frighten him, might remind him of our father's weight loss, of the way his legs, as he sat at breakfast in his suit that fall, after he had given up on chemotherapy but was still going to work. His legs were like dowels under his flannel pants, thin dowels under those gray flannel pants, now so baggy. I should work out. I could join a gym. I could get a weight bench. At least get some free weights, a few dumbbells. I should. I have to. I have to present to Toph a body exploding with virility, flawless. I need to be the acme of health and strength, instilling confidence, dashing doubt. I need to be indomitable, a machine, a perfect fucking machine. I'll join a gym. I'll start jogging. We throw the frisbee farther than anyone has ever seen a frisbee go. First, it goes higher than anyone has thrown before, so that in the middle of the pale blue, there is only the sun's glazed headlight and the tiny white disc, and then it goes farther than anyone has known a frisbee to go, with us having to use miles of beach from one cliff to the other, thousands of people in between, to catch it. It's a trajectory that's important. We know that. That the distance relies on both velocity and angle of flight, that you have to throw the living shit out of the thing, and also put it on the correct trajectory, an upward trajectory, both straight and steady, not too high, not too low, because if it's sent on the right upward path, its momentum will carry it almost twice the distance, the second half on its way down, the second half a gimme, meaning that you need only provide for half of its distance yourself, its momentum providing for the second half, when finally its forward progress slows and slows and stops, and it falls, as if parachuting, and then we move and run under it, our quick steps scratching into the wet sand, and when it falls into our hands, because we are there. We look like professionals, like we've been playing together for years. Busty women stop and stare. Senior citizens sit and shake their heads, gasping. Religious people fall to their knees. No one has ever seen anything quite like it.